to keep the horn going. Between you and Coal River Mountain Watch, well, it's all that stands between what the horn does and silence. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The last few days, I've been talking at length about the economy, about AIG, about the plan of Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. And I've got news on the economy again today. In fact, I've got a lot of different issues I want to talk about today. Everything from the economy to Tim Geithner's plan to Barack Obama's proposal on the tax deduction for charities. I've got comments on the Israeli election, on the choice and rejection of Chaz Freeman, on the anti-bullying statute in North Carolina. I've got discussions of the D.C. Right to have representation, along with the connection with a bill to take away all of D.C.'s rights to stop guns in the city, to an accounting change, to card check, to coal, to your various comments on my website. Now, whether I get all that done or not, I don't know. But it's the Week in Review, lots and lots of miscellaneous topics. It also gives you a chance to call in and tell me what's on your mind at 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. But sometimes you just got to combine a bunch of little stories and just, they're not worth a whole show on their own. But the news on the economy that I want to give you, it may well surprise you. Now, you may think that there's nothing left to surprise you on the economy. We've heard it been called the worst since the Great Depression. We know the depths of despair of the financial industry. I've talked at length about how we got into this crisis and what I think is the way out. Well, here's something that I think may surprise you more than anything else I've said on the economy, and that is that I have good news. That's right, good news on the American economy. Do you remember what that sounds like? I know it's been a while, but the economy appears, and these things are always fragile, but the recession appears to have hit bottom and not be getting worse anymore, which means that it's actually starting to get better. Now, it doesn't mean we're out of the woods. All it means is that we're deep into the woods and we finally turned around and are heading back on the long path to sunlight. And that, my friends, is good news. Perhaps the clearest sign of the good news is, looking at all the economic data, is orders for durable goods. Does that sound like an economic mouthful? Well, but that is what companies are doing. They're ordering machinery, they're ordering equipment. And that's the kind of thing that they only do in better times. In worse times, when inventories are high, companies don't order more machinery. After all, if they're laying off workers, they don't need more equipment. But it appears that with the very, very low interest rates, with the revival of the housing market, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, there actually is a good sign for the economy. And it began, surprisingly to most, last month, February of 2009. That's right. in the first positive sign since, well, let's see, 2008, since July of 2008, the orders for durable goods went up 3.4%. What does that mean? Well, let's talk about the months before. In the last months of the Bush presidency, you find durable goods going up 1% a month, down 1% a month, and then starting in August, they're down 5.5%, 8.5%, 4%, 4.6%, 7.3%. So from August 08 to January 09, businesses were contracting, getting smaller, ordering less equipment. When you add it all up, it's about 38% less equipment. But now they're ordering more. In the very first month of the Obama presidency, the things he did, the stimulus package, lowering of interest rates, helping to restore the housing market, finding a solution to people who are getting their houses foreclosed upon, giving us the prospect of getting energy and health care fixed, well, businesses started buying again. And this isn't the Wall Street stuff. Now, we know that, by the way, when Timothy Geithner's plan came out, Wall Street sent the Dow up. But I'm not someone to judge the economy on the Dow. I recognize that stock markets can be wrong. After all, many were evaluating Citibank and Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and AIG at high numbers before they found out the toxic rot in their bellies. So I'm happy the Dow's up. I'm happy that's improving people's 401ks. But when you look at something like this, not related to speculation, not related to stock prices, but pure ordering goods, businesses are back in business. Now, again, I'm not saying that we're out of the recession. I'm not saying that we've recovered. But what I'm saying is things aren't getting worse anymore. And that, in and of itself, is a good sign. We have stopped digging the hole. We have started filling it in. One of the best pieces of news is in the housing market. The sales of new single-family homes increased 4.7%, the first increase in 7 months. Now think about that. Sales are up 5% in existing homes. In 1 month, sales are up 5%. And of course, you know why. Interest rates are historic low. It's a great time to refinance if you can. It's a great time to buy a new house if you can. Housing prices have gone down to historic lows. And the Obama administration gives you an $8,000 tax credit if you're a first-time home buyer. So, people are building again. America is moving again. And I think this administration deserves a lot of credit. It will take months to get out of this. I have predicted in the past we won't be out until the end of this year, possibly into 2010. But we are already coming out. And it's the fact that the Obama administration acted so quickly and Congress acted so quickly that deserves credit for what I see is a light at the very end of a dark tunnel. So I think that's a very good thing. One of the things that it did increase the stock market and has, I think, increased people's optimism is the plan announced by Tim Geithner on Monday, the Treasury Secretary, not without some criticism, but how to get rid of the toxic assets of the banks. And I don't know whether Tim Geithner was listening to my show yesterday or not. Probably he was too busy to do so. But if you read his plan in today's Washington Post, you can see that his long-term systemic fixes are very much along the lines of the things that I talked about. No company should ever be too big to fail. And lo and behold, I read the proposals. I read the resolution authority. What is that? That's to give the federal government, and it's not clear which branch. It might be the Treasury Secretary. It might be the Fed. It might be the FDIC. But the power to do what the FDIC does in banks, to take over troubled institutions, to wind them down, to say to executives, sorry, man, no bonuses. We have the right to break your contract. To say to creditors, sorry, you're getting a haircut, 50 cents on the dollar, and to do so without all the difficulties of a bankruptcy court. Now, maybe the answer is we need to revise some of bankruptcy law as well to make it easier to do these things in bankruptcy court. It doesn't really matter to me too much which branch of the federal government is in charge, but my own personal choice is the FDIC. bankruptcy judges, that's one person, one judge. It can be overturned on appeal, but by the time you get on appeal, a lot of good or bad can be done. And then you look at the branches of government. Well, the Treasury Secretary, I'm okay with President Obama's Treasury Secretary. But what if we get a Republican in office? What if they refuse to use this power appropriately? Many are talking about the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve is sufficiently insulated from political winds, but they don't always make the right move. It was Ben Bernanke, in fact, who decided to bail out AIG and to largely forget to get those haircuts and those bonuses before they gave the bailout. Now, maybe he couldn't do it. We all know AIG basically said, we have a ticking time bomb here. We're going to blow up the whole economy. Still, I like to think that a company floundering in the waters might be willing to give some concessions before we throw them a life raft. The Fed isn't perfect either. I like the idea of the FDIC. The FDIC is about as much a bunch of bureaucrats as anybody. They are even more politically insulated than the Fed. They tend to run things very well. As I said, the FDIC has never, ever lost a dime in insured deposits. Now, they're not perfect. Any institution can have people run it the wrong way. Obviously, any action should have to be undertaken with input from the Federal Reserve, with input from the Treasury Secretary. But it seems that Geithner is thinking a lot of the lines I am and giving this power to the FDIC. And, well, I think that's a good idea. They're also talking about regulating all derivatives, all of them, hedge funds and private equity firms and venture capital firms and all that over-the-counter stuff. If you want to make a trade in the United States, to the United States, from the United States, and it's bigger than a certain amount, we're not going to stop farmers from trading their tractors. But if you want to make a large financial transaction in the tunes of tens of millions of dollars, you got to notify somebody. You got to let the watchdogs be aware of what you're doing. In fact, largely that was the law beforehand, right? Before some enterprising person at J. Morgan Chase created the idea of a credit default swap back in 1997, these things didn't exist. You had insurance. You had brokerage accounts, stocks and bonds and futures and options. You had bank accounts, all of which were regulated already by the appropriate entities dating back to the time of the Great Depression. And it worked pretty well. There were excesses. You remember the savings and loans crisis under Ronald Reagan. But those excesses were largely because the regulators didn't do their job, not because they didn't have power to do their job. The problem was individuals, unlike the problem now, which is systemic. But President Obama and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner understand that. Now, Tim Geithner, I'll be the first to tell you, is not a very charismatic man. He's not. He's a bureaucrat. He's a wonk. He's an intellectual. He's someone who crunches numbers. Frankly, many people said the same thing about Al Gore as not having a lot of personality. And, you know, in large public settings, he largely doesn't. But he's a very competent person. And I may not agree with everything Treasury Secretary Geithner is doing. A lot of it, the details, are still to be worked out. But let no one doubt that he's a good man trying hard to do the right thing. And that in and of itself is such a wonderful thing. Isn't it? That in and of itself, to have the idea that you have a president trying to do the right thing, trying to care about all of Americans, not just those at the top, trying to fix these very complex things. Remember, as I said, credit default swaps didn't exist until 1997. They weren't legalized until 2000, when, as I reported in detail yesterday, in the middle of a huge omnibus, multi-hundred-page bill, there were a few lines undoing the ban on gaming, the ban on bucket shops, the ban on gambling on transactions that you don't play a part of, that had existed since 1909, based on a panic in 1907. And I want you to understand the difference. I Lottie mentioned that she heard me on Richard Green's program last night, Air America. He invited me on to describe this, but, you know, unlike On the Horn, they give me about 5 minutes to describe these very complex things. There's only so much you can say in 5 minutes. But one of the things that I was trying to make clear there is the difference between legitimate financial bets, speculation, and what I consider to be illegitimate ones, understanding that they were both legalized from 2000 on. So when I say illegitimate, I don't mean illegal. The crime is not that these people did illegal acts. They weren't like Bernie Madoff doing a Ponzi scheme. The crime is that they did legal things. But the difference really is not that hard to understand. It's betting when you've got your own hide in the game and when you don't. We all understand that when you're betting on the Super Bowl, it may be technically illegal, but basically it's perfectly okay to bet on who's going to win the Super Bowl. As long as you're not in the Super Bowl. If you're in the Super Bowl and you're playing in it, well, then a bet would be vicious, would be horribly illegal because you could throw the game. Interestingly, for financial institutions, it's exactly the reverse. You should only be able to make the bet when you're in the game. Let me explain. If I have insurance on my house and my house burns down and I get paid back for my house, really, I'm just made whole. I've lost a house. I've gained the money for the house. And frankly, if I burn down the house, that's a crime. That's arson. Or at least it's insurance fraud. But I get insurance to hedge my bets against losing my house. That's fine. We don't have a problem with that. But if my neighbor bets on whether or not my house burns down, that's a little more sketchy. In other words, I have no problem with credit default insurance. On my own credit, right? I have no problem with guarantees on loans. If Bank One doesn't pay me, I get insurance from Bank Two. I have no problem with someone insuring that I pay my debt because otherwise they'll be out a lot of money. That makes sense. They want to make sure if I owe money to someone, he wants to make sure he gets his money back. He's not so sure that Mark's going to pay, so he gets insurance in case Mark doesn't pay. That makes sense. He's in the game. The problem with these credit derivatives was that people were betting on other people's stuff. This is where it becomes like gambling. This is where it becomes like Las Vegas. This is where it becomes like betting on the Super Bowl. What people were doing were betting that AIG would fail or that Citibank would fail or that they wouldn't pay their loans or that the subprime mortgage securities wouldn't be good, and they weren't even owning those securities. They were just looking out, seeing the system was weak, and speculating that the whole system would fall apart and making a bunch of money while doing so. Now, that's the difference between, I was asked last night about short selling, between short selling and this side bet called credit default swaps. Because when you're short selling, even if you're short selling, and that can be abused as well, you are required to buy back that stock. Short selling, when you sell a stock at a price, you think it's going to go down, and you're required to buy it back within 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. You're on the hook, and you make the difference if the price goes down, and you lose the difference if the price goes up. But credit default swaps, these credit derivatives were people betting on other people's bets. You could have a security worth $1 million with $1 billion in the side bet. And so you have the tail wagging the dog. Couple that with not lack of transparency and the fact that they didn't include these things on the books because they weren't insurance. They were a swap. Sure, it was a swap of premium payments for a plan to pay if the thing fails. It would be like me saying, I'm not going to get house insurance. I'm just going to pay you this stream of funds that we're not going to call a premium, and if my house burns down, you're going to pay me a lump sum that we're not going to call house insurance. It was insurance. They just didn't call it insurance to avoid the regulation. What Geithner's plan would do is to regulate these things that should have been regulated. And so I don't know whether you're listening to me last night, Secretary Geithner, but let's just say, oh, I don't know, good minds think alike. And how weird is it? How weird is it to have a president of the United States that actually come to the same conclusions that you do, that I do? How weird is that? I mean, I hardly know how to comprehend something like that. A president, a government with reasonable, rational solutions to seemingly intractable problems that think the same way I do? As I say on my blog, now how can I give you the news the government doesn't want you to know when we have a rational, intelligent, transparent government? It's going to be hard, but you know what? I really don't mind that they're making my job a little bit hard. Yeah. It's just nice to finally have someone in charge who I got some trust for. Now, to let you know this is a good idea, all you have to do is look at the Republicans opposing it. John Boehner, the leader of the Republicans in the House, said, and this is a direct quote, "This is an unprecedented grab of power," he said, talking about Timothy Geithner's plan to allow things other than banks to be winded down, all those things that were too big to fail. "It's an unprecedented grab of power. And before that occurs, there ought to be a real debate about whether we give that authority to the Treasury Secretary." Okay. I'm okay with a real debate. And I'm okay with not necessarily giving it to the Treasury Secretary. As I said, I give it to the FDIC or the Fed or all of them in combination. But the idea that government should be involved, how can that be an open question? Let's go back to Boehner. He says, quote, "You need to look at insurance operations as an example. They are regulated by states. What interest would the Treasury Secretary have here, and why would he want this power?" Unquote. Can you believe Boehner said that? Yeah, why would he want this power? Who could possibly imagine an insurance company causing any problems at the federal level? I can't think of one. Is there an insurance company that could possibly fail and cause us to bail them out and pay bonuses to the executives and because they're too big to fail, that has three initials, two of which are the same as in pig, and the first one is the first letter of the alphabet? Never heard of it. Can you believe Boehner is questioning the need for this? I mean, if you want to question the solution, fine. But questioning the problem? Let me read that quote again, just to show you how incredibly clueless the Republican Party is. The leader of the Republicans in the House says, quote, "You need to look at insurance operations as an example. They are regulated by states." So far, that's true. I agree with Boehner so far. Then Boehner goes on to say, "What interest would the Treasury Secretary have here, and why would he want this power?" Oh, I don't know. Maybe because a certain unregulated gambling of the largest insurance company in the United States led to a worldwide economic depression costing taxpayers trillions? No, can't be that. Can't be that. Must be socialism. Yes, that's it. It's socialism. It's all because Obama's a socialist, I guess. Meanwhile, in other economic security news, and by the way, if you want to call in, folks, 877-4-HEAD-ON, let me know what you think about all this. You don't have to agree with what I'm saying. That's perfectly fine. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366, to really understand what John Boehner is saying. I have to go back to a comment he made 1 month ago. Again, this is a quote. "We're not kind of in the minority. We're in a hole," John Boehner said. "I've told Republicans to get the idea out of their minds that they're legislators. This is the party of just say no. The country's in a hole. The country's in a bind. And the Republican Party is doing everything they can to keep the country in that hole. Because in the words of their leader, Rush Limbaugh, if Barack Obama fails, and we hope he does, people will vote Republican. This is the party, of course, that puts their own interests ahead of their country's. It would be as if the Democrats, after September 11th, had said, oh, Bush, you got a mess there. You're on your own. Good luck. Of course, they didn't do that. I was there that day, and the Democrats swarmed back on the Hill and sang God Bless America and worked together to pass a lot of good legislation. Some of it bad. Some of it was rammed down their throat. I was there when we created the first Patriot Act, the good one, before they rammed down our throat the bad one. But the point is that most Americans, you would think, would put aside partisan divides and work together for the good of the country. John Boehner, if he has a problem with Geithner's proposal, he could say what his problem is and what his proposed solution is. But instead, he's saying things like, I don't see why it's necessary. Insurance companies run just fine. Unregulated gambling has done well for this country. I don't think even he believes the BS that he spews. Now, if he were cared about his country, he would say, well, I'll work with the Democrats, and I want this solution rather than this solution, and I propose it's run by the Fed rather than the FDIC or Geithner. Fine. But denying there's a problem? These guys could be deep in the hole with water filling in, and it would go up to their neck. And they would say, I hope I drown, because if I drown, it's your fault. I've told Republicans to get the idea out of their minds that they're legislators. Boehner said, we don't want to be part of the solution. We want to be part of the problem. One other thing, just to make sure in my weekly review that you remember, because there's a bunch of stuff going on, and some stuff gets through the slips through your fingers. And that is, there's a op-ed in the Washington Post by Arthur Levitt. Remember him? He was the chairman of the SEC under Bill Clinton, when the SEC actually was regulating companies and did a pretty fair job, not perfect, but far better than the current job. He's alerting us to something that may seem obscure to you, but is quite important. It has to do with the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB. They're kind of the granddaddy of accountants. They set the rules, much as maybe the AMA does for doctors or the ABA for lawyers, though they're part of the government. Well, they're getting pressure from people like Republican Randy Neugebauer. I think that's it. Randy Neugebauer, Republican of Texas. Who said, don't make us tell you what to do. They're getting pressure to relax their accounting standards. To say that these complex derivatives are worth, well, what the market bears. Which has been the accounting standard for decades in America. Indeed, I don't go back that far, but perhaps for more than decades. Maybe for 100 or more years. But the idea that banks' assets should be valued at what an open market would sell them for makes sense. If you have something and you want to know how much it's worth, you see how much you could sell it for, not how much you think it's worth. Right? I mean, you know, my grandmother's old wedding ring may be worth millions of dollars to me because of its sentimental value, but that doesn't mean I could sell it for millions of dollars. Well, Republicans, and then some Democrats too, are pushing the FASB to change the rules. To change the rules to say that the companies don't have to give the current market value because, well, they don't intend to sell it right now. They can give the value they expect it to be 3 years from now. Well, if I knew the value of securities assets 3 years from now with certainty, boy, I'd make a real killing in the stock market. That's the point. We hope these things will be valued at more a few years from now, but we don't know. And to base reserves on a guess and a hope and a prayer leads to exactly the kind of unregulated gambling that we had in the first place. It's a real bad idea. I want to thank Arthur Levitt for bringing it to my attention, for helping me bring it to your attention. This is something that we need to defeat in its infancy. Toll free, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I'd like to hear from you on any of these economic concerns on your mind. If you have any questions, any challenges, any problems with it, let me know what you think. One other thing you may want to comment on is the Obama rule changing charitable contributions. I don't know if you heard about this. Basically, it says that if you're super rich and you give a charitable contribution, you're limited to the 28% tax bracket. That makes sense to me. And I'll tell you why after the break, along with the other miscellaneous news of the day. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Obama should stop pussyfooting around and go tell Attorney General Eric Holder to indict Dick Cheney right now for war crimes. Just take a look at the statute, Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code, Section 2441. It says that someone is guilty of a war crime if he or she commits a grave breach of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, and then it defines what a grave breach actually is. One such breach is torture, or the conspiracy to commit torture, which Cheney was clearly in on, as when he repeatedly defended waterboarding and talked about the need to go to the dark side. Another grave breach is cruel or inhuman treatment, or the conspiracy to inflict such treatment. Once again, Cheney was supervising this treatment in the White House, which would qualify as committing this crime. One time it got so ghoulish that even Attorney General John Ashcroft asked, "Why are we talking about this in the White House? History will not judge this kindly." Still another grave breach is intentionally causing serious bodily harm or conspiring to do so, and Cheney is in trouble on that one, too. By the way, according to the statute, for each of these offenses, Cheney could receive life in prison, and that's where he belongs. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
from Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. It's the Week in Review. Lots of little topics. I've talked a lot about the economy in the first half hour. I'm going to talk about some other things now, though you're always welcome to call in and discuss any topic you want. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. When I do the Week in Review, all topics are valid. If you have a comment on anything and everything, please feel free to call, or you can post comments on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. One of the things I wanted to mention, and I realize this is Bob Kincaid's realm, and he's going to have a lot more to say on this than I will. He is the expert, not I. But I, for one, was very pleased to see the Environmental Protection Agency at least start to take a stand against mountaintop removal. They issued just yesterday basically a statement saying that they are reviewing the Clean Water Act to make sure that these things are proper. Now, if you heard my shows with Bob and with Lorella last week, you know that some of these communities, particularly Lorella's, were on the verge of being destroyed. They were on the verge of being bombed out, and they were just waiting on the last permits from the Army Corps of Engineers after a Fourth Circuit, the conservative circuit court in Virginia, West Virginia, had just ruled that they could go right ahead. Well, the EPA administrator, the new one, Obama's administrator, Lisa Jackson, has sent letters to the Army Corps of Engineers objecting to proposed operations in West Virginia and Kentucky, saying the two projects pose a serious threat to aquatic resources of national importance. Aquatic resources of national importance. Does that mean you can't drop fill in the rivers? Looks like that's exactly what it means. Obviously, she has to be held firm. The EPA did announce later on that this was not a moratorium, but Jackson said in her statement that the two letters reflect EPA's considerable concern regarding the environmental impact these projects would have on fragile habitats and streams. I have directed the agency to review other mining permits requests. EPA will use the best science and follow the letter of the law in ensuring we're protecting our environment. To say that is a sea change from the Bush administration is an understatement. And for many of these communities, it came just in time. And that doesn't mean that Bob and others can let up the pressure or that you and I can let up the pressure. There will still be intense lobbying by coal interests and all the money they give to Republicans and Democrats. But it's really nice to at least see the EPA start to turn the page. I thought it was funny to see the quote from William Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association, who questioned why the new administration will potentially put hundreds of jobs on hold when EPA stopped the bombing, that every 9 days is equivalent to Hiroshima. Why would you want to dismantle a state's economy, Rainey said. Does that mean in the steep terrain of Eastern America we're not going to have roads? We're not going to have economic development? We're not going to have Walmart? God forbid, we might not have Walmart. No, Mr. Rainey, in fact, as you know well, there are more jobs than the old-fashioned mining, the kind under the ground, the ones where workers are protected by unions. It's not an easy job or a good one, and we all want to get off of fossil fuels, but it's a heck of a lot better than blowing the tops off mountains. Even if you only care about jobs, it's better for that, too. So we'll have more jobs and more economic activity and maybe even a few more Walmarts. Nice to give some good news for a change. So we have good news on the economy, good news on coal. What else? Any more good news around? Most of the rest I have is kind of bad news. Oh, well. Let's move on to the bad news. Struck me in the newspaper, this is one of those tiny little things that I find fascinating. There's a anti-bullying law in North Carolina. Now, you would think this would be non-controversial. The North Carolina legislature is debating, or was debating, over whether or not we should protect school children from bullies. I want you to think about this debate. On the one side, there are people that think that little children should not be beaten up. On the other side is those North Carolina legislatures. They're encouraging kids to beat the crap out of other kids. It may surprise you to know the bullies won. Yes, in North Carolina, the bullies won. You see, the anti-bullying proposal would have required school districts to adopt policies protecting students from violence and harassment. What's wrong with that, you say? Well, conservatives pointed out that some of those people being bullied, beaten up, harassed, and beaten to a pulp were gay students. And social conservatives flooded their offices with phone calls and emails saying, we want those gay kids beaten up. We don't think gay kids should live. They should die. They should be murdered. They should be beaten. And we don't want school administrators stopping someone from beating up a gay kid. Kind of hard to believe it's true. But it is. The House in North Carolina passed the bill. The Senate voted it down. The Senate of North Carolina actually supports beating up little kids. It's one of those things that kind of hard to believe until you read it. In other news, it's not such good news. Those of us in the District of Columbia who want to be American citizens, who want to have a right to vote and have representation in Congress, who want to have, more rights than, say, the slaves did or women did. The residents of the District of Columbia want the right to vote. And they don't have it. And I don't think most Americans even realize that they don't have it. I should say we don't have it. I live near the District of Columbia, not in the District of Columbia, but I'm certainly part of the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. For the last 10 years or so, license plates in D.C. say taxation without representation. And there's no other nation's capital in any democratic country in the world that denies its citizens the right to representation in its legislature. But D.C. is the last American colony. D.C. is occupied territory. In D.C., the residents are required to support the government through taxation. The government is sitting right in the middle of them, but they can't decide what goes on. And worse, not only the District of Columbia has no representation in Congress, they have no vote in the Senate, they have no vote in the House, but they can't even decide what goes on in their own district. Whatever happened to states' rights? Well, the District of Columbia isn't a state. They have no rights. We may think Idaho or Massachusetts or Oregon or Florida or Alaska might make stupid decisions, but they have a right to make them. If the residents of Montana want something, they can vote for it. If the residents of New Jersey want something else, they can vote for that. If the residents of D.C. want it, they can't, because they're owned by Congress. Well, to rectify this very long-standing injustice, 200 years of no representation in Congress, finally, a bill looked likely to pass. A bill to pass the House, giving Eleanor Holmes Norton, the shadow D.C. representative, her one vote. Out of 435 in the House, she was going to get one vote, too. And then just to throw the Republicans a bone, they were going to give one to Utah as well, the next state under the census, and increase the number in the House to 437. There'd still be no vote in the Senate. There still wouldn't be statehood. There still wouldn't be D.C. autonomy. It wasn't much, but at least it was a step towards democracy. Think of it like when they technically gave blacks the right to vote, but there were still Jim Crow laws keeping them from voting. It passed the House. It came to the Senate. And a bunch of Republicans and a few gun-toting renegade Democrats added a provision to say the District of Columbia has no rights to regulate guns within the District of Columbia. If you want to bring a semi-automatic pistol, maybe a shot-down Uzi or a M16, into the nation's capital, a few blocks from the White House, you go right ahead. Here's what I don't understand. If Congress thinks this law is so good for the District of Columbia, why don't they make it nationwide? Why don't we just give every six-year-old child a semi-automatic weapon? And D.C. has been given a Hobson's choice. That is a choice with no choice at all. They can have partial democracy as long as they let guns roam freely in their streets. In a city that, I should say, prior to its gun restrictions, was known as the murder capital of the United States. Now it's doing quite well, thank you. They can vote for giving themselves a vote in the House and losing their right to even pass a law on guns. It isn't just a law taking away certain gun restrictions. They're taking away D.C.'s right to pass any law on guns. It almost makes me think, and it's horrific to say so, and obviously I don't support this, but I wonder what would happen if some lunatic started shooting up around the Capitol. Then, and only then, would Congress understand why it's not good to have semi-automatic weapons in a crowded city environment? Is that what it has to take? Do people have to die before they understand this? I hope not. But I really feel for the people of the District of Columbia. Representation is not something that you bargain for. When blacks wanted the right to vote, they demanded it as human beings. When women wanted the right to vote, they demanded it as human beings. When white men without property wanted the right to vote, they demanded it as human beings. When residents of the D.C. want the right to vote, oh, well, it's contingent. We'll give you part of the right to vote in one house, but not the Senate, but only if you give up your right to stop killing in your streets. As a resident of the Washington metropolitan area, I'd like to ask all of you to call your member of Congress. After all, we're enslaved, right? We're oppressed. We're occupied territory. But it'd be great if you, our owners, our overlords, our masters, who call your member of Congress, take pity on the people of Washington, D.C., and ask them to give us our right to vote without preconditions. We're not harming anyone. We're not lobbing rockets into neighboring cities. Could we have the same rights to vote as other Americans? Please? A place where they are lobbing rockets, of course, is Hezbollah continues to lob rockets into southern Israel. It doesn't get much news. It seems it only gets news when Israel responds to these rockets, but they're happening day after day, rocket after rocket. If you think there's a ceasefire, you're wrong. But note how the press only focuses on it when Israel responds. Why is that? In Haifa, thankfully, the police managed to defuse a 200-pound explosive bomb found in a crowded mall in Haifa. I've been to Haifa. It's a beautiful city. And whoever designed that, and I'm sure it was Hezbollah or Hamas or maybe someone in Fatah, it had ball bearings and other sharp-edged shrapnel designed to kill as many people as possible. Thankfully, they did manage to defuse the bomb. There hasn't been a bomb that has exploded in Israeli territory of that size since 2002. There was only one suicide bombing in Israel in 2008. The wall is working, and it's gone from hundreds of civilians dead a year to only one dead in 2008, so I think that's good news. Otherwise, in the Israeli elections, I'm also very glad to see that the Labor Party, Ehud Barak, has joined with the right-leaning Likud Party, Benjamin Netanyahu, to form a unity government. I really hope that Labor can tone down some of Likud that Barack can tone down some of Netanyahu. I realize there's no one really to negotiate with right now, as long as Hezbollah is launching missiles. But I like to think that if they could just find some peace accord, that maybe, just maybe, down there in Gaza, they could overthrow that government and have one that believes in peace. The Israel lobby was in the news recently, complained by a guy named Charles Freeman, who was our former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He was appointed as chair of the National Intelligence Council, not by Obama, but by the guy that Obama hired. Now, the National Intelligence Council, they're the ones who give those estimates. You remember those NIE estimates, the one that was so dreadfully wrong in 2002 that said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction? Well, I would think that those things, above all, you don't want to be politically manipulated. That is something you don't want to be unbiased. The problem with the Bush administration was, as the Downing memo says, they fixed the facts around their policy. They cherry-picked. They chose data to support their arguments rather than looking at the data fairly and then deriving policy from it. Well, Freeman had a bunch of problems. One of it is that he used to work for the China National Offshore Oil Corporation. He got paid by them. It's owned by the Communist government of China. And he also got paid by the Middle East Policy Council, which receives ample funding from Saudi Arabia. And in that regard, you should know that his company was investing, among other things, in Sudan's oil sector. The regime of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir, the guy who's committing genocide in Sudan, in Darfur, who's been indicted for that genocide. And this guy, Charles Freeman, who was going to run our National Intelligence Council, was the director of a company, a Chinese-owned company, that was investing in genocide. Freeman claimed he never received money from a foreign government, but he did, indirectly rather than directly. China gave it to the oil company gave it to him. Saudi Arabia gave it to the Middle East Policy Council, the Middle East Policy Council gave it to him. And to give you an idea, by the way, of the problem of his appointment, Congress has voted to divest all government aid to Sudan. Freeman, his appointment would have violated that divestment. But even worse is what happened in China. I'm sure you know about the occupation of Tibet by China and the conditions that people are under there. It's particularly brutal. Freeman wrote after the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989, defending the Chinese government, mowing down the protesters. He wrote, this is a direct quote, "I do not believe it is acceptable for any country to allow the heart of its national capital to be occupied by dissidents intent on disrupting the normal functions of government. Such folk, whether they represent a student uprising on behalf of the goddess of democracy, should expect to be displaced," unquote. I'm very, very glad that Charles Freeman is not directing our National Intelligence Council policy. And I have to say, it's interesting, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, took no position on Freeman. But largely the fact that he seems to be in debt to the Chinese government and Saudi Arabia, I'm glad he's gone. And frankly, I find it surprising that he blamed Israel. Why didn't he blame Tibetan interests? After all, they were against his appointment. On another issue, card check, we know it's coming around the pike. This, of course, is the ability of Americans to join unions. And it's something that has been, I think, quite unfairly portrayed in the press. You find Republicans saying, well, card check, that's just not secret elections. What is card check? What is the Employer Free Choice Act? What it is it allows people to join unions at any time without the pressure of an impending election. When you think about it, elections are merely pinpoint events in time. And that's necessary in democracies. You understand why in electing the president you have to have an election on a certain day or time. You can't have the president changed by opinion poll. But with a union, why shouldn't you be able to have one at any time? These elections are expensive. And usually it's on the back of the union, and then the employer brings everybody in and requires everyone to undergo this propaganda that the union is afraid to do because people can be fired. All this card check does, and it's done, by the way, by independent people. It's not like other people know whose names have signed on. It says if you sign on and you want to join a union and it reaches a majority, you get to form a union. You can withdraw your name, too, and then you don't. And if at any time more than 50% of the people want to join a union, bingo, you got the union. Is that too much to ask? Well, apparently it is for Arlen Specter. Arlen Specter is one of those so-called moderate Republicans, senator from Pennsylvania, who in the past has expressed support for unions, expressed support for an AFL-CIO to win elections. He is a Republican in a blue state. Pennsylvania may not be shiny blue, but let's face it, they're fairly blue. They voted for Kerry. They voted for Gore, in addition to President Obama. Specter was the 60th vote. All of us expect Al Franken to take his seat to be the 59th vote. All of us expect this to be filibustered. Arlen Specter was going to be number 60. Now, I don't know whether we can get Olympia Snow. I don't know whether we can get Susan Collins. The card check is important. At a time when employers have more power than ever, at a time when unemployment is rising, the Employee Free Choice Act merely says that employees should have the same bargaining power as employers. And that it shouldn't have to be where they have to spend all this money and then have an election and have all this pressure. No. If the majority want to be part, you form a union. If they don't, you don't form a union. But Arlen Specter reminds me of what my old boss, Barney Frank, used to say about moderate Republicans. He said, first they tell you they're going to do the right thing. Then they do the special moderate Republican handshake, which Barney Frank defined as a neck around your throat. If their vote doesn't count, they're allowed to vote as they please. If Specter were not the 60th vote, let's say there were 60 Democrats in the Senate, well, they would vote to give employees the free choice to join unions.